Some people live in guilt, consumed in sorrow, setting themselves up for a doomed tomorrow. I learned a great deal from what life has shown, like don't follow the crowd, get a life of your own. I ran the streets crazy, seen every kind of sickness, had to get a grip and straighten up with the quickness. Scrapes with the law, problems at the crib, did my share of robbing and nearly had to do a bit. Experience is taught you to check oneself and keep a balance to your physical and mental health. If I don't give it to you, homie, then who's gonna? Instead of seeking peace, so many choose drama. Compulsive behavior, irrational statements lead to errors and blunders and actual kisses. Some people treat themselves with no respect. As for me, I'm making moves with no regret. Still, it makes me wanna holler. Look up in the sky at the constellations. Look into your soul, feel a revelation. Your mind in its most positive state will connect with others who equally relate. Planets come together in a peaceful formation so we can surpass the pain and degradation. Suffering and sacrifice will not be in vain, cause the beauty that is true will always remain.
That's the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, out of Nolens, as they call it, with a remake of Marvin Gaye's iconic Inner City Blues, featuring the late guru of Gangstar on vocals. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's Tuesday, January the 29th. And President Barack Obama is expected to sign a $50.5 billion emergency relief measure for Superstorm Sandy victims as soon as it lands on his desk, after House Republicans had stripped it earlier this month of spending unrelated to disasters. The Senate voted 62-36 to release the emergency aid, aimed primarily at helping residents and businesses, as well as state and local governments, rebuild after the storm. The biggest chunk of the aid, $16 billion, will fund Housing and Urban Development Department community block grants, and of that amount, about $12 billion will be shared among Sandy victims, as well as those from other federally declared disasters between 2011 and 2013. The remaining $3.9 billion is solely for Sandy-related projects. Las Vegas is the venue today for a campaign-style push by President Obama to encourage swift congressional approval of his immigration reform proposals, which he says will give millions of undocumented immigrants a pathway to citizenship, tighten up immigration law, and enforce border security. Obama's public rally comes a day after a bipartisan group of senators unveiled their own plan for addressing the issue, which remained in legislative limbo for several years. The simultaneous immigration campaigns were spurred by the November presidential election, in which Obama won an overwhelming majority of Hispanic voters. The results caused the Republican Party to look at itself again because it had previously opposed immigration reform. 51% of Americans believe that undocumented immigrants should be able to stay in the United States and apply for citizenship, according to a CBS poll released just yesterday. Senator John Kerry has won the unanimous support of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to replace Hillary Clinton as the new Secretary of State. The full Senate is expected to confirm Kerry later today. And Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood announced that he's leaving the cabinet after 4 years. LaHood, 67 years old, a former Republican congressman, says he will stay until a successor is chosen and confirmed. He is the sixth person of a 15-member department, 15-member department heads, I should say, to leave the Obama administration since the beginning of his second term. Just a couple of things to keep tabs on as the day goes on. I wanted to return to where I left off yesterday, but really to make much more time because I didn't get any opportunity at all, and I thought it was so unfair, it just made me feel very guilty. So I'm announcing early, 888-874-4888. There were so many of you wanting to have your comments and to participate, but we didn't have a chance to do that yesterday, so we'll catch up and give you the space you need today. 888-874-4888. And while, you know, you get your thoughts together and make your calls, I just wanted to finish off the scenario. We were talking about this 60 Minutes interview by Steve Croft of on CBS with President Obama and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And it was so clear that the whole exercise, which, by the way, Steve Croft made it clear on his side of the table to say that, he didn't arrange it. He felt the need to point out that it was President Obama who insisted that he participate in the interview itself, which is unusual. And it communicates some very troubling things about the president and about people around him. It was so clear that Hillary Clinton, who had sustained some damage, I don't care what they say, as bossy and as obstreperous as she was and downright rude in some instances as she was, the media covered it as her being passionate. She was just rude. But she did sustain some damage, and that was that the Republicans were successful in attaching to her two very important things that, should she decide to run for the presidency in 2016, she'll have a rough time getting rid of these attachments. Attachment one was that she accepted responsibility. They absolutely got her to do that, to accept responsibility, and then she later twisted and said, we accept responsibility, but not blame. All right. Whichever way, the fact is she had, by herself, associated herself with the utter failure of the department to protect the lives of four Americans in Benghazi, Libya, last September 11th. So that was a major piece of damage done. It is now, she is now going to be associated with that event, and there's nothing that she can do about it because actually she herself had initiated the association. And the second thing that they were successful in attaching to her was that while she was busy running around and, you know, racking up all that mileage as perhaps the nation's most traveled Secretary of State, while she was tending to things at that level, her department appeared to be in chaos and in systemic failure. And that was a determination of an independent board of inquiry. I say independent with a kind of snicker because the arbitration board that looked into it really was appointed by her. And they did not ask her any questions. So she got a free pass. And the role of the president in this interview was to anoint her publicly and to take the edge off of that and say that, you know, she was one of the finest, he said, one of the finest secretaries of state. And he was so lucky to have her and so forth. On the flip side of the coin, Hillary Clinton exhibited some very interesting behavior as a very patronizing woman. She called the president her partner and friend. And, you know, in the world of protocol, and Americans are not that, they're not that circumspect with respect, you know, with regard to protocol. Proper protocol, you don't talk that way about a president. You know, you're supposed to have a thoroughly professional relationship, but she basically thanked him for his hard questions and for his steady hand, as she said. You know, he was very supportive, but in fact, it should be the other way around. Now, what this brings me to, and that's where I'm going to go. I just want to say this, and then, of course, we get to your calls at 888-874-4888. The transaction looked like an interview. You know, there is the host, the 60 Minutes host, Steve Croft, and you have two people being interviewed who just happened to be the president, the head of the country, the head of state, and the Secretary of State. And we know that the head of state is just that. He's the head of state. The attitude of Hillary Clinton is, well, he's not my boss. I'm here with my friend. And the world should know that, you know, we're all palsy-walsy and everything. That kind of familiarity breeds contempt, and it says something about the dynamic that even the President of the United States cannot escape. And I'm talking about the racial dynamic. As president of the country, and it happens in all countries observe the same rules. You don't get together with the president as an equal in any interview. But it said something that the president inserted himself into this interview that way. He wanted it that way. He made it clear. Yes, we had a rough time in the beginning, but I have come to regard Hillary as a very strong friend, he said. And he went on to, you know, just heap the accolades on Hillary Clinton. This way, she's able to slither out of the State Department, out of the cabinet, out of the White House, and begin her own afterlife, weighing all of the options that she has. And the person who would have done the rehab job on her somewhat damaged profile is none other than the highest person, the highest officer of the United States, the head of state himself. You can't get better than that. If the roles were reversed, it would never happen. Protocols would be followed. And indeed, what President Obama did for Hillary Clinton, he certainly did not do for Susan Rice, who has now become something of a distant memory. He did not indicate that he regarded Susan Rice as a trusted friend and all of that stuff. His thing was, when the heat started, you know, piling up, he buckled and backed away from the nominee, who, by the way, I mean, and let's be objective about it, she certainly did not write the erroneous talking points. This is nothing of her doing, but she was fed to the sharks And the person who did the feeding ultimately was the president himself, the person who nominated her. So when you see this kind of behavior, you can't help but ask yourself the question, what is it that Barack Obama is lacking, that he places himself time and again in situations where the public can construe him as making an extraordinary effort to accommodate other people, even at the expense of himself, despite the fact that a particular constituency overperformed in terms of electing him? And we know there were many constituencies that elected Barack Obama. But he seems to have no loyalty to his own folk. He seems to have no particular allegiance to that. And we will discuss as we see the cabinet appointments going and so forth. This is a very interesting dynamic. So the issue of race is so complex that even the head of state is not immune. And he's a very educated man. The same thing I'm reminded of David Dinkins, former mayor of the city of New York, the first black mayor of the city of New York. David Dinkins is running for office, and it's supposed to be a historic occasion. And the black community is very excited. You know, we'll put him in, if that's where he wants to go, we'll get him in office. And so did a really, really wonderful job of supporting his candidacy. The first political office that he opens, the first campaign office he opens, is not in Harlem, where he comes from, but in Kew Gardens, Queens. And it spoke volumes. And for the entire term that he was there, David Dinkins might as well have been a piece of furniture, because nobody really paid attention to anything he said. The view was that, you know, well, he dresses nicely. That's all they kept saying. That was as far as they were willing to go. And even to this day, in matters relating to the city of New York, to provide a point of reference, say, about things happening in the city of New York, he is seldom, in fact, he's almost never sought out or quoted. He's already been relegated to the periphery of the political arena. He's a non-entity. And for the entire time that David Dinkins was in office, I can't tell you not even one major initiative that he successfully pulled through that was a high priority item on the list of African Americans and Caribbean Americans in the city of New York. Not one. He's a caretaker. He was a caretaker mayor. He was there to provide a kind of bridge between one real mayor and another real mayor. And since leaving office, I mean, we don't hear about him at all. Barack Obama is a highly educated man, but I am willing to say that he is showing some signs that would cause one to worry about just how solid is he in his own skin. And by that I mean, what is it that compels him all the time, it seems, to be deferential to the broader white community and distant from African Americans? He isn't talking to black people, it doesn't seem so. And he's not dealing with the issues that are their priority items. know the president has to be the president of all the people. I get that. But you can't tell me. I mean, you went in the first time and you broke, you know, the history record. And they did it a second time. You're in for the second term. And so far, this president has reorganized his schedule of priorities in such a way that the issues that the African American community has identified as important to it simply are not yet tended to. And this is term number two. This is year number five. So it just raises that question. That's all I'm saying. Ron, you're on the air from LA.
Good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Fine. Yes, your program is excellent in your assessment of particularly this interview over the weekend with the president and Hillary Clinton. It's spot on. But I think us as Americans, we're in a terrible dilemma in terms of the forces of propaganda. Because you listen to your assessment, but then if I turn on my TV and I watch MSNBC do an analysis of the speech or Hillary's presentation or the situation of Muammar Gaddafi being assassinated brutally, and it's you're in two different universes. And so us as Americans, we're in a dilemma because that major force if we're driving on a freeway, listening to talk radio, Randy Rose is saying how great Hillary is and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, despite the killing, the drones, et cetera, or the TV, we're constantly bombarded how great the president is and if the pretty wife and his family, and it's all great. But then we listen to your accurate political assessment and a few others, like on Black Agenda Report, et cetera. But that's a tiny sliver of the media. And so as a result, the greater public, and particularly the African American public, is just bombarded with this false narrative, and I think it's really dangerous because in a way it's kind of false, like Patrice Leda saying, no, don't eat lead, don't eat cyanide, that kills you. Look at this example, this person, look at that whole field of dead people from eating cyanide. But then if this other major media says, oh, yeah, eat cyanide, it's good. And come on, just say. So with your political history and knowledge, what do we do about this? This is serious.
Well, I think one thing that you can do is to pass the word and help grow the audience. That's important. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, we tend to be passive consumers of information. And that's just a general rule. We let the medium itself make up our minds. You know, we don't even want to think. We just tell me what it is I need to know and tell me how I need to think about it. So we get pre-digested material. Secondly is, we let our guard down because there is a power relationship in media. And the power relationship is the listener or the consumer of information is an idiot, and the people talking and showing you things, they are the geniuses. Uh-huh. So we defer, and we actually, you know, we have to check ourselves many times because we let down our guard, and therefore we abdicate from the responsibility we have to be very careful about the information we consume and to examine it for contradictions. Because the people who control what we read and see and hear in the way of information every day, these people are extensions of the system that we historically have had to lock horns with. So they are performing in a role that is natural to them. Remember, like, you know, I'll give you an example. Remember we talked about the fact that in the gun control discussions that Joe Biden had started and went all over the place.
Right.
And remember I talked about, you just have to look at the room and you see that this is a case of white America talking to itself. There's no intent to deal with where the problem really is.
Mm-hmm.
Because those people are not even in the room. So they're signaling to you, you don't exist.
Right.
Remember, we went when the presidential campaign was on, and even the black and Latino and Asian journalists submitted questions saying, look, since you don't want us physically there to participate in the questioning of these candidates, could you at least consider asking these questions? And they ignored even that. So the it's a reflex action of people who understand themselves to be and accept that they are part of the powerful side of the power equation. And you see the ways in which they guard their flanks. It's as simple as that. In that interview, Steve Croft and Hillary Clinton really were the people having a discussion. Barack Obama was just happened to be there. But Steve Croft was interested in talking to Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah.
He was interested in talking to her because she was by far, I mean, even referred to as a kind of rock star of
exactly.
She was
exactly.
a phenomenon. So they're having, right in the face of the president, the man sitting there physically, and they both are talking around him,
mm-hmm.
but the interviewer really has a greater interest in Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. So when we, if we ignored that signal, we would get that, wow, there was an interview, but that's not an interview. It's a conversation between two people who identify in the context of that conversation, they share membership in the power elite.
Well,
one is the interviewer, one is the interviewee, and the other guy is sitting there to anoint the other, the person who came with him.
And but also, too, there's a follow-up 1-2 punch that's going to be aired on MSNBC countering any criticism of that interview. They you know, that's
of course.
That's what I'm saying.
They do that.
I mean, that propaganda is intense.
I'll give you another example. Even when the host is other than a white person,
mm-hmm.
the intent
oh, yeah,
is still
yeah, like,
to shore up the interests of the dominant party. For
mm-hmm.
example, again, Soledad O'Brien's Who is Black in America?
Mm-hmm.
Aired again. CNN aired it again over the weekend. And you wonder, what is the problem? What is this interest in defining, getting black people to visually communicate the angst and the anxiety and the psychological debilitation they have with being black? What do you call yourselves and how do you feel? And people are talking about all these problems that they have as black people dealing with the range of melanin they have, whether they're black, you know, all the stuff. But the real question really is, the question isn't who is black in America. The question is, who is white in America? That's the question. So they have all this stuff going on, and you are seeing an example of black people in catharsis about being black. They're having real psychological problems with this notion of blackness. The agent of information is herself you know, her mother, I believe, is Cuban, and the father is Irish or something. And she is, we let our guard down, because now here is somebody who kind of looks like she belongs in the conversation herself, being the agent of information, and the information that is delivered to the entire world is, I can give you an authoritative view about what black people are really experiencing, and they're experiencing a great deal of psychological debilitation over this business about being black. And yet, that is not the question. The question isn't who is black. They made laws about this. We've had laws telling us who is black, going all the way back to Jefferson and way beyond. We have laws on the books. I mean, you want to know who is black? Go read law. Read Supreme Court cases and case law. You will find out who is black. But we never hear a discussion on the side of the powerful, quote-unquote, the power side of the equation, discussing who is white in America. Wouldn't that be refreshing?
But see, that then puts black people or minority people, see, they always want to project us as not having self-awareness, self-identity, self-recognition. So they'll constantly put out propaganda that works against that. You know, I mean, from my perspective, black people dealt with that back in the 60s about who's black and this, that. And it's like, yeah, we all black. We black and we proud. End of story, on to the next issue, period. But see, they want to bring that back up to give you self-doubt, to say, oh, no, black, I don't like black. That whole self-doubt, the take away your self-confidence, et cetera. See, anything that promotes that, that's what I'm saying. A lot of this propaganda, that's what it pushes.
But you would not get somebody from, let's say, an expert like the late Amos Wilson, who can tell you why it is that blacks are experiencing what they're experiencing. And the political, the psychosocial ramifications of political decisions with respect to the powerful basically dominating the lives of people and taking away the power from them. It's so typical of any group of people. But to approach this discussion as if it were a real deep discussion, it isn't that deep. The really deep discussion is, how do whites interpret their whiteness?
Mm-hmm.
How do they adjust to that? What is their consciousness about privilege? And that is the compelling argument. Now, tell me, who's black in America? No, we know who's black, okay? Whether they accept it or not, there are laws that tell us, they've been telling us this for a long time. It gets more and more complex. It was invented. It's an invention. And all of the pillars of society have gone into making this invention real. Okay, we get that. Now, take us where we need to go. And they will never get there. But even when the agent, as I said, the agent of information, the person hosting the show, is herself in service of the myth. I'm bringing you information, but it really isn't information. It is an assurance to the power elite that their formula is working just fine. Folks are confused as ever, and they're mad as hell about it. Oh, it's working great. I'm waiting for the day, and I'm gonna call Soledad and say, you know, you really need to do a story. You really need to do a series. Who is white in America? You really need to do that. Because we have been studied all I mean, we've had so many postmortems and conducted on us in our minds. Tell us, who is white in America? Now, that is a very interesting challenge. Thanks, Ron.
All right, thank you.
I really appreciated our discussion today. I really enjoyed it. 888-874-4888. We'll take a fast break and come back to your calls right after this.
Moment where the tables will turn, when the lies, the myths, and the fables will burn, and that which is pure will then shine through. So it's time to leave the negative thoughts behind you. Inhale and breathe the good air in. Exhale, release impurities within. If you don't stand for something, you will fall for anything. Let's see what this new day brings. And still, it makes me wanna holler.
It does make you want to holler. This is Sutrice Lead, and you're listening to Lead Stories on the Progressive Radio Network, a phenomenal place to be. And I really do encourage you to pass the word on and let us grow this audience and get some good transmission of information going back and forth. Now, I talk a lot about race. I should say the false construct of race. And I talk about it because it happens to be at the heart of what makes America, America. Nobody's, I mean, they wouldn't say that, but that it is. Every day is just shaped that way. And everybody's affected. Whites are affected. They are groomed to believe, for some reason, they're automatically superior. And they are privileged. Blacks, on the flip side of the coin, are groomed to believe that they are inferior and powerless. If we regard ourselves as progressives, as people with a far more informed vision, we have to tackle this one thing all the time. Not with a sense of blame, but with a sense of analysis and understanding. And we therefore will be able to see these contradictions. And that is why, because we are in the business of communication, we have to focus on it. We have to pay attention to it, because it is a permanent thread in the fabric of American life. Just about everything. I mean, you're going about your business. You're not even thinking about anything. And I'll give you a story. Many years ago, I got a call. I was the editor of a newspaper, the City Sun, and I got a call from a woman who said she'd like to talk with me. And it was about a magazine. She was part of a team launching a women's magazine, and thought that I might be a really good candidate for the managing editor, the executive editor of the magazine, to run the magazine. So I said, okay, I'll come see you. And I went. The office was on Madison Avenue. And I got up to the floor, and there's a lot of activity going on. They were actually constructing the offices on this entire floor. And so the interview was conducted in a kind of a small corner of the entire floor, hastily put together with just a bunch of blinds just marking off the space. So we started talking. And she seemed a little stunned, but it happens this all the time. For some reason, when I show up, people look at my name, and then they look at me and they go, really? So, okay. So we started talking. And, about 5 minutes or so into our discussion, she just shoots up out of her chair. And she says, I'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back. I said, okay, maybe, nature calls and she had to respond right away, whatever it was. But she had a sense of urgency and left the room. And comes back with 3 other people. And now there are three other people, this woman who is interviewing me and me. There are five of us in, huddled in this one little space, barely, that can barely accommodate two, and there we are all huddled together. And she said, now tell me about what your ideas are and so forth. I said, and, you know, I said, well, you know, I started talking just generally, wanting to know what the thrust of the magazine and so forth. And she says, what did I tell you? She's talking to the others now. What did I tell you? Isn't she frightening? Now, I recall many things in my life. Frightening was never one of the things I've been called. I checked. My horns were retracted. Yes, they're not visible. My tail also was retracted. It was not visible. I did take a shower. You know, my hair is nice and neat. My nails are clean. And I brushed my teeth. What more do you want? But what she was saying was, what was terrifying, what was frightening, was that I could sit down and just off the cuff, we're just talking, we're just blowing some steam, okay? That's how I interpreted this, the beginning of our conversation. We're just bantering. And just the banter scared the hell out of this woman. She shot out of her chair as if she had met a species she just never expected to meet. I mean, I could actually put a sentence together with a subject and a verb and an object. This is phenomenal. This is really terrifying. And I said, my gosh, to myself, you know, I didn't have the heart to tell this lady, if you're frightened by just a little banter we're having here, it's a good thing we really didn't get into a deep conversation. You probably open the window and just throw yourself out of it. But that was an amazing thing. Why would that be terrifying? Why would that be frightening? To have some cogent ideas, and we're in the business, we're in the communications business. And even so, I'm frightening. I had never had anybody tell me that in my life. So I clearly understood that was going to be the end of the interview. And, you know, I thanked her for her time, et cetera, et cetera. And it was interesting to get a look at how they were moving. It turned out they didn't get off the ground at all. But to actually state to me, to my face, or to others in my presence, isn't she frightening? Simply because a couple of ideas happened to roll off my tongue one after the other. And, you know, I was just conjecturing, you know, talking in a general sense about, you know, magazines and what magazines can do and so forth, especially magazines that are targeting women. So that day, I had to take, you know, I had to take some time and digest that experience. And it taught me a lot. It taught me that while you are busy just going about your business, the mere idea that you can possibly be an aberration of the stereotype is so frightening to people. Could you imagine if there were a whole bunch of people like me, let's say? People would be dying of strokes and heart attacks and anxiety and all kinds of stuff. Simply because of the notion in their heads that the color of your skin means you should be limited intellectually. And they actually believe that. And it is essential for them to believe that in order for them to function. In order for them to function as whole people, they have to assume a sense of superiority and supremacy. And any little jiggle to that causes them to freak out. I mean, you're going to run and get people to, you know, come see. You know, it's like you're the new animal in the zoo. Now, I didn't have the heart to tell this lady that for the purposes of our discussion that day, I had to bring my level down several notches so as not to outpace her. I don't know what the heck she really would have killed herself if we were going at top speed. I had to decelerate in order to not lose the lady. Okay? But that's what I mean, we're all caught up in this stuff. And it's everyday life. It is everyday life. The black community and the gun issue illustrated that point. The black community is viewed as a petri dish full of bacteria. And the concern of others in power about this petri dish full of bacteria, the concern is that the bacteria are contained. No contagion, no leaking into any other areas, no infection of any other areas. We have the bacteria contained. The apparatus of government is doing just fine. Systems are doing just fine. The results are exactly what we want. All systems are working. And even in the progressive community, people have to struggle with this thing. The notion of race, which gives birth to the notion of superiority and supremacy, which is why we constantly have to talk about it. And when I look at the Green Party and other alternative parties, I look to see that they reject racism and articulate that, because that is part of the work. Part of the work is for us to engage in honest discussion about this issue, because it is a huge problem. It's a structural problem in America. We didn't make it so, but that's the way it is. So we have to fight against it. And the best way to do it is not to pretend it isn't there. And don't play games like CNN and Soledad O'Brien saying, oh, we're doing really informative journalism. We look, here are black people just absolutely in a lather over the psychological burden they bear about being black. I say, you want to do something courageous? Do a piece on who is white in America and how did they get their notions of whiteness? And what does whiteness entitle them to in the society? Now, that's a real service right there. All right, we are close to the end of our time here today. I want to thank you so much. I really want us to be comfortable about talking with each other. Obviously, we come to each other in a spirit of respect and with a sincere desire to understand different points of view. It's really not important whether you agree or disagree. It's important that you participate in the discussion and examine your own thoughts. Examine the offerings of others as well, because that's serious education. I absolutely believe so. I absolutely believe that. So we will be seeing each other again tomorrow, God willing, and the creek don't rise, as they say. And really, pay attention to things that are not said, things that are not shown, and look for the layers of meaning in just about everything. You'll find it right there. Coming up next, Economic Update with Richard Wolff, and we'll be seeing each other tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for your time.